It's all the files of the whole park. It tells you everything.
Sir, he's uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
It's basically synonymous with all the boomer fear-mongering surrounding the internet. Deep web, dark web, scary web. Tales of an open hitman market, cannibals, international terrorist forums. The dark web gets a lot of accusations, and while there is legitimately some creepy shit to find there, there's a lot of misconceptions. Today on Cyber, we have Emily Wilson, VP of Research at digital risk protection provider Terbium Labs, and a hardcore expert on all things dark web, to tell us what's actually on there and how it's really being used in 2020. I'm Ben Maku, and you're listening to Cyber. So Emily, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And, you know, I've been meaning to do this episode because I think there's a lot of boomers out there and people who generally are just afraid of the dark web or the deep web or the shadow web. I don't know how, there's so many ways of putting it.
Tonight, Team 10 is getting an exclusive look at the dark web. It's the internet below the internet, where all of your personal information is bought and sold. You can hire a hacker to destroy someone's life or to buy illegal drugs with a few clicks.
Yeah, no, I feel like every time I have this conversation with someone, there's some new, more enigmatic, slightly more frightening term people have come up with for it. It's a poorly understood part of the internet, which makes it really great for, figuring out the scariest possible thing you could project onto it.
Yeah, it seems like it's the boogeyman of the internet.
It is, which is really great for people who are writing TV shows and movies, or people who want to make something up. Because when you have something like the dark web, right, and it's always said in those terms, then whatever you say is happening on there. You know, you have live human auctions, or you can go eavesdrop on ISIS. People will believe you because it's unfamiliar to them. And we've seen enough frightening things with technology over time that it seems plausible. I'm sorry to say that's just not true.
And you just know, and because I've never watched the show, because I would rather just swallow thumbtacks, but you just know CSI Cyber? That's the thing, right? You just know that they dove into that one.
I'm a behavioral scientist. Fancy for a human lie detector. I work crimes that start in the mind, live online. I'm a cyber cop.
Yeah, no, I was watching a show recently that I thought would be some good escapism, and I got two episodes in, and all of a sudden it was, oh no, he's an elite hacker from the dark web. And I'm like, oh man.
Oh God, what show? Come on, tell me.
Blind Spot.
What is that?
It's an interesting show on Hulu. I started watching it because, going to show my nerd creds here, there's a character from a D&D Twitch channel that I really like who's also on the show. And I thought, hey, this is like an interesting FBI drama. And then the dark web showed up and I had to just
You had to stop. Yeah, you had to fade into the ether like, bye.
I did.
Okay, so tell me, let's define it. What is the dark web? What is the deep web?
Sure. So the dark web, the deep web, the clear web, the surface web, it's the internet, which is not the answer that anyone wants to hear, right? Because it takes all the mystery away. These are all just parts of the internet. And at least when it comes to the clear web and the deep web, these are parts of the internet that we use every day. You know, when you grab your phone in the morning and you check the weather, you check sports scores, you check the news, that's the clear web. The deep web, which, you know, many people have seen this iceberg graphic that shows the hidden part of the internet under the water waiting to get you, where in this scenario, you are the Titanic, is also part of the internet that we use every day. There are more pages to it than sort of the clear web or the surface web. But the reason that we don't see those is largely for security purposes. You know, when I log on to my bank account, I can see my account summary page. I have to use my credentials to get to that page. But you couldn't get to that page on Google if you tried to get to it, at least not if my bank is doing their job properly, which is something we can't take for granted anymore. But that's part of the deep web. When we log into our social media accounts or we connect to our intranets at work, those are all parts of the internet. They're just not parts of the internet you can get to very easily. And so we can see why things like that wouldn't show up on Google or other search engines. And then there's the dark web, of course. Also, just part of the internet, but it's one step removed. You can't get to it on Google. You can't accidentally stumble your way onto the dark web. You might need something like a special browser in the case of the Tor network, one of the most popular dark web networks. But the way that you get to it is you visit the Tor Project website, and the Tor Project does great work on privacy and security. Everyone should check them out. You visit their website, you download the Tor browser, which is just a variant of the Firefox browser that many people use every day. You download it, you install it, and it allows you to browse the internet through the dark web network. It has some baked in privacy and security to make it more difficult to see where you're coming from in the world and to stop people from tracking your internet activity. But that's it. Congratulations. You're on the dark web. It takes 5 minutes.
So essentially what it is, you're still using the same internet connections and all of that, but it's just onto a enclosed, more secure system that isn't used as popularly and broadly on the clear web.
Exactly. And as part of being part of that that more enclosed system, there are some, at least in the case of the Tor network, there are some nice pieces that makes it harder for you to be tracked, right? This is a system that was designed for privacy and security. And those are neutral goals. Those are valuable to people who are looking to stay safe in a part of the world where their traffic might be monitored by authorities, as it is for criminals who are looking to sell off social security numbers.
By using an underground network called Tor, which hides the identity of whoever is using it, by bouncing web traffic among servers around the world. Andrew Luman, who runs the Tor network, says it also allows people in oppressed nations to avoid censorship.
So instead of someone being able to say that I'm sitting here in Baltimore and someone from my IP address in Baltimore is trying to access a website, your traffic is going to be encrypted multiple times over and routed through a bunch of different parts of the world. It might bounce through Canada and France and Germany before coming out onto the internet from Switzerland. And that's a really great way to stay safe and to stay private, which sort of benefits both sides of the aisle.
And there has been some pretty, you know, notable black markets that have been used on these dark web sites before in the past.
Absolutely. This technology, you know, again, just reminding folks that the technology is neutral, but criminals have been co-opting technology for their advantage for as long as there's been technology, right? They continue to adapt and they continue to build these empires. One notable example of this is Silk Road, which is a dark web market, you know, of infamy that most people have heard of.
In its 3-count complaint, the government says a man known as the Dread Pirate Roberts was able to rake in $80 million in 2 years through an illegal site he created, a secretive online marketplace for drugs, one so perfect that it could make the street corner dealer obsolete.
And the reason that Silk Road stands out is because it was the first in now several generations of dark web markets to combine this this privacy technology that I'm describing with the dark web side with something else that brings anonymity, cryptocurrency, and putting those into one criminal e-commerce platform to allow people to be private while they're browsing and to pay anonymously, which created a sort of a closed loop model. So people weren't, you know, paying with PayPal or Western Union, which is really good for the police. It's a great way to get caught. Silk Road was the first market to find a way beyond that and make the criminal model, dare I say, a bit more sustainable.
And, you know, it was famously a place you could buy drugs. And, you know, I know that the founder got wrapped up in this in some weird way, but there was talk of you could buy hitmen on this website.
The internet has a little-known and mysterious twin known as the dark web. It's a place where online services offering illicit drugs and hitmen are just one click away.
It is a perpetual myth of the internet.
Perpetual myth.
A perpetual myth, and I think, you know, something that I would strongly encourage the listeners to think about a little bit more is that people are scammers on the internet. People are scammers on the regular internet, right? You get weird links for off-market Ray-Bans you can get for $10. People are scammers on the dark web. If you say, hey, I can provide hitman services to you, I just need a deposit first, that's a really good way to make money and defraud people. you don't have to follow up with it. And you can, you know, in some cases, people would use that information. They'd get a deposit and they would get the hit information. And then they would blackmail people for the rest of the money because, hey, if you don't pay us more, we're going to take this to the police and let them know that you're trying to order a hit on your neighbor.
I also remember when it was the early days of this, there was like this really stupid website for on the dark web that was like, it was a hitman service. And it literally used the images from the movie Hitman.
Oh, yeah. No.
Do you remember that? I was like, this can't be real. Come on, guys. Like, yeah, really?
The branding on the dark web is very web 2.0 at best. you know, one thing I appreciate, some of these sites don't take themselves too seriously. You know, some of the Russian fraud forums will decorate for Christmas. They'll have like a Santa and sort of like a snow gif effect in the background of the forum where they're all trying to trade stolen credit cards. People use popular branding for their vendor names or their shop locations or whatever. You know, there's a Mike Tyson carding shop. There's a Donald Trump carding shop. You know, they know how to play this branding game. They're just trying to make money and they know how to get your attention.
Absolutely. And also, you know, I think it's also worth mentioning that while there's a lot of stupid stuff on the dark web, there's also some pretty nefarious stuff on it.
There is. Yeah. You know, I think people have this idea of all of these terrible things that you could possibly do. And they're a little disappointed when they find out that you can't, you know, go participate in a live human auction, for example. But they sort of skip over the fact that, you know, you can buy any kind of identity information that you want at pennies on the dollar, and you can get wholesale discounts on stolen credit cards, you know. And by the way, you know, people are selling off information on infants and children, you know, just because it's not the big scary thing that we have decided it looks like in movies doesn't mean that it isn't problematic and deeply concerning.
So what are some of the, you know, the actual bad things you found monitoring the dark web?
I mean, I have to say, you know, in this job, bad is a relative term. Working on the dark web definitely changes your perspective on what bad looks like. You know, I'm certainly very lucky in the work that I do day to day, which is really focused on fraud data. I don't have to work with any of the child exploitation materials. There are a lot of people who are doing really good work trying to shut those sites down, but child exploitation material does exist. It's largely kept separate, I should say, from the fraud material or the drugs or the malware. Those communities not only sort of hate each other, but they all hate child abusers even more. It's sort of a
prison
effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. If you show up in the wrong place, not only are you going to, like, you know, getting told off is the beginning of your problem. Like, they're going to find you and they're going to make sure the police know about you. Besides the child exploitation, you know, it is concerning to see something I talk about a lot is just child data being sold. Not anything having to do with physical abuse of any type, but people are just selling off children's records from hospitals or government agencies. You know, when you're an infant, there are a limited number of places your information can be held. So seeing that kind of data circulate is problematic. And also just seeing, frankly, the sheer tonnage of records that are in circulation, social security numbers, voter databases, bank accounts, video streaming accounts, travel accommodations, and again, wholesale discounts on payment cards. If you buy enough credit cards, they'll give you a bulk discount, right? It's an economy. This is not some sort of, you know, sloppy back alley deal. These are well-structured e-commerce platforms with reviews and dispute mechanisms. There is an entire economy for stolen information. And it's lucrative and it's robust. And we don't hear anybody talking about it.
And I imagine things like stalkerware and revenge porn also flourish on these types of sites.
Absolutely. You know, there are certain communities where it is a little bit more prevalent, but it's reasonable to assume that these communities are overlapping. And you can, you know, there are certainly places where you can get more sophisticated malware or ransomware or whatever you're looking for. But you can also just buy, you know, people sell guides on how to do crime, right? You can go buy guides covering everything from how to hack someone's Facebook account. So really good for stalking or for blackmail of some kind, or even just vandalism, to, you know, how to bypass customer service protocols at a bank, or how to use this glitch in the software to open fraudulent bank accounts, how to do SIM swapping. You know, it really lowers the barrier to entry for criminals. And in these guides, they even have referral links. You know, hey, if you're looking to do this kind of scheme, you're going to need some social security numbers. If you don't have any, my buddy is selling them, but make sure that you use my referral code so I get a kickback. Right. It's a whole system. They have a whole system in place to make sure that they're making money, to make sure that their friends are making money, and to help each other do this, to help each other build tradecraft on how to do crime.
And how do the authorities keep track of all this and trace the dark web?
You know, it's difficult work. And law enforcement has been doing a really good job of this over the last few years. You know, we've seen a lot of major takedowns, not only of major dark web markets, things like Alphabay and Hansa, which were taken down. You know, Alphabay, people hear about Silk Road, but Alphabay is still the largest dark web market we have ever seen. It was the Amazon of the dark web. And they took it down in this big coordinated law enforcement effort involving a bunch of, you know, international factions. And that was a huge blow for about a month. And then everybody picked back up. And so law enforcement, even when they're having these big successes and taking these markets down, criminals and vendors and even market administrators are used to a certain amount of instability being baked into the work that they do. And they found that this model is successful. These markets or these shops are successful. And so as long as they lay low a little bit, as long as they learn from, you know, the mistakes that then led law enforcement to being able to take down their predecessors, they just pick back up again. You know, they keep regenerating. There are these new generations of markets that have different security features, and, you know, it all just keeps turning.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, in 2020, we're looking back at a period of the internet for the last, you know, 20 years where it's popularly used as a tool. It's part of our society. And something like the dark web, it's never left, right? People think it was this new creation. It's just been this backbone of our internet usage for years. I mean, we were talking earlier. It's just like, it's like Skype. It just never goes away.
It never goes away. And, you know, it's interesting for me to see the rise in popularity for everyday internet users to maybe turn to the dark web as a privacy or as a security tool. As we're seeing more and more headlines, you know, I know Vice is doing a lot of good work in covering this about sort of predatory data collection at a commercial level. Right. And so people are looking for ways to avoid, you know, the ever growing surveillance state, or to have their information tracked by different marketing services or different, you know, internet tools. People turning to the dark web as a tool for that, as a way to keep themselves private and secure. Meanwhile, criminals, in addition to sort of their, you know, their markets that keep churning, are spreading out onto social media. Right? They're getting more blatant about this. They're not just operating on dark websites. They're also operating on .coms or in Facebook groups. And what an interesting way to expand the market, right, for your goods and services, for someone who maybe wouldn't have gone onto a dark website and tumbled some Bitcoin to buy your stolen accounts. But hey, if you meet them in a Facebook group and say, you know, this big show is coming back on, wouldn't you love to have credentials for this streaming service that you're not subscribed to? Hey, I can do that for you. Just send me $20. You know, it starts to change who this might be appealing to.
Right. I mean, I guess to put it bluntly, it's sort of like, you know, it's not people selling arms to barbecue, human arms to barbecue. It's like,
yeah,
people selling mass data and things like credentials to streaming services and drugs. It's almost as if it's sort of regulated itself into almost what human beings look to do on a regular basis on the open internet.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing. You know, people don't give these communities credit for being self-regulating. You know, the drug community, by and large, on the dark web is a, you know, self-policing institution where people are really focused on safety and on harm reduction. People are posting reviews to talk about purity and about dosing and consistency and stealth. And drugs on the dark web cover the gambit from purely recreational drugs to the sort of pseudo pharma, pseudo recreational drugs, something like a Xanax or an Adderall, all the way over to just purely pharmaceutical drugs people are trying to find cheaper options for because their healthcare isn't covering it. Right. And This community really tries to take care of itself because they want to make sure that no one is overdosing because somebody said that a pill was dosed this way and actually it was double that, right? They understand that the risks are associated there. And on the fraud side, you have people who are sort of the information side, right? It kind of covers the gamut from people who are just looking to not have to pay for streaming service to people who are looking to, steal a couple of credit cards or get access to a bank account or commit ID theft, all the way up to your sort of professional, quote unquote, cyber criminals who are running large scale phishing scams to go after all different types of businesses as sort of their main business model, as sort of their main profit machine, people who are building these scalable fraud services so that they can make money that way and then probably go spend it on what? Streaming service subscriptions?
Well, on that note, Emily, the dark web isn't so dark all the time, but it's definitely complicated.
It is definitely complicated. If I can leave you with one final anecdote as we wrap up, it's the end of January here, so I feel like I would be remiss in not mentioning that the dark web does celebrate Valentine's Day among its many other holidays. And one vendor, I don't remember if it was last year or a couple of years ago, put together what I thought was just an artful package of fraudulent services. It included a Netflix account, a Domino's pizza scam guide, and an Uber account. It was the Netflix and chill package just in time for Valentine's Day to remind us that the dark web it's just like the rest of us.
I love ending on that.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Jason, welcome. The Cypher 2020. Here we go.
It's been a couple weeks. I was reading our reviews on Apple Podcasts today, and someone said they really like the podcast, except for Cypher. They think that we're annoying. So rude.
Yeah, but then I also get people being like, I love Cypher.
I'm trying my best.
Yeah.
Someone on Twitter DM'd me and said, hey, I really love Cypher, and I love Cyber. You guys are great, and I love your... back and forth banter and your knowledge and things of this nature, but you say like too much. Could you just stop that? Which I take to heart, but also it's like, oh, could you just stop doing that thing that makes you really self-conscious?
Well, Jason, I love your flowing long locks myself.
Thank you.
I think they're elegant.
What I'm trying to say is if you say anything mean to me, I'm going to find it and it's going to hurt my feelings.
I know.
Let's get started. Are you going
to? Yeah. I'm ready. Okay, here we go. All right, so this is a huge scoop from none other than JC, our boy, JoJo Cox. I want to stop calling him JC. I want to start calling him JoJo Cox.
I'm into that.
JoJo Cox, killing it. Some leaked documents. Tell me.
This is a huge story. So Joseph, as well as a reporter at PC Mag, it was a collab. Learned that Avast antivirus, which is used by more than 430 million people around the world, is collecting all of your browsing data and then filtering it through a subsidiary called Jumpshot. And then from Jumpshot, they're selling it to the biggest corporations on earth. So Jumpshot's clients include Google, Microsoft, McKinsey, Bain.
Oh, God.
Yeah, Home Depot, Sephora, Condé Nast.
I don't mind Sephora.
You know what? They can have your
browsing. They can have my info.
Yeah,
I get a lot of products there. I get a lot of nice products there, I got to say.
So there's a lot of background to this story. One, Avast was caught selling data back in, I think, October or maybe December. It was late last year through a browser extension that is on Chrome and Opera and Firefox. And once they were caught doing that, they got kicked off of the Google Chrome store and like the Firefox extension store and what have you. And there were a couple senators who were like, hey, y'all shouldn't be doing this. So they stopped doing that, but then they started, well, I think they were already doing this, but they continued to collect data using their antivirus program, which, as I said, is one of the most popular antiviruses in the world. It has more than 430 million users.
So wild.
And so not only, like, that's arguably much worse because the antivirus has a, you know, it's more integrated with your system than just your browser. So in theory, they could be collecting more information about your computer itself. And so they are collecting data like every click, every search you do on Google, everything that you buy.
Not chill.
Yeah. And they're timing it down to the millisecond. We saw actual consumer data. And so someone could say, hey, you know, this person on Amazon bought a product at this exact millisecond. And then Amazon, if they wanted, could cross-reference that with their own data and use it to de-anonymize the user.
Well, you know, this kind of goes back to something we were talking about on our end of decade episode and where we're seeing some of the stories going next. And I think one of the things this year we both agreed on was that the next few disclosures are going to be how people are peddling our data. You know, like all of this stuff, it's coming out. And something like this is a perfect illustration of that.
Yeah, there were two big responses to this scoop, which was a lot of people read it. It was shared widely on the internet. One was, oh my God, this is really bad. We need to do something to stop this. And the second was, is this actually news? Like, which I think is the most annoying thing you can possibly say to a journalist. Like, it's not easy to get documents from within companies. And to know the specifics of this, I would argue, is really important. Like, of course, we know that our data is being sold, but the specifics of how it happens, how much it's being sold for, what it's being used for, the level of granularity, like that's the new information and that's the scoop and that's where regulators can get involved.
I also just think the vastness of it is unknown. I think it's even crazier than what you and I, even though we cover this kind of world, even understand.
That's the thing. I have no idea. I mean, Avast is a huge company, but it's
like, what else?
It's one of dozens, if not hundreds or thousands of companies that are doing stuff like this. And it's, we know that there are cookies all over the internet. You know, telecom companies have been caught selling this sort of data before. So it's not at all surprising, but it is scary. And it's also important to know the specifics so that we can A, like know what to do about it, and B, you can make more informed decisions about what products you use.
Here's another story I love, because I love covering this company. And, you know, we used to have Carolyn Haskins, RIP, Carolyn. But Palantir, continuing on that beat, we have Ed on the story. Palantir CEO finally admits to helping ICE deport undocumented immigrants.
Yeah, so Palantir's CEO is named Jeff Karp, and he was at Davos, of all places.
Of course he's in Davos, yeah. In some bunker with the rest of the Illuminati. Anyway, go on.
In this interview, he is wearing, like, a bandana. Like, yeah. He looked like he had just come out of Burning Man.
What is that?
Yeah, he's...
This is the Burning Man corporate aesthetic. I don't get it.
I don't really get it. But he was talking to CNBC and was basically like, hey, yes, Palantir products are used to help ICE and DHS deport undocumented immigrants. And we do this in order to protect, quote, the West, which is really weird language. It's very coded.
Protect the West?
Yeah, the West is very much like a Ben Shapiro, like our culture is being taken away.
Oh, yeah, like the Judeo-Christian, like, protection unit, like the Knights Templar.
Yeah, it's very, very odd. So in any case, we've known for years that Palantir works with ICE and that they work with Department of Homeland Security. There's been tons of protests by activists as well as like college students and facial recognition people. And it's, you know, Palantir is sort of like, it's not patient zero, but it's one of the most publicly protested companies in America, I would say. Like, people are
it's up there. I mean, it's, I think it's definitely, for a company that doesn't get a lot of like mainstream headlines, it gets a lot of hate too.
Yeah, and it's also not consumer facing. Like, no. They work with they work with law enforcement, they work with government, they work with
CIA,
military, that sort of thing.
It was a CIA funded company.
Exactly. Founded by Peter Thiel and this guy Jeff Karp. In any case, like, we've seen documents and we know that they work with ICE and we know that they've been part of the child separation program. But every time, you know, Palantir just says no, but we don't help deport immigrants.
Right. But do you have the ability to say to them, we will sell you to this technology for these applications, but not for these ones?
Again, we work with HSI, which is a distinct group. Mm-hmm. But no, I mean, like, we support the American government. I think our CEO has said many times that Silicon Valley shouldn't be the people who are picking winners and losers. We live in a democracy. We want that democracy to be self-correcting. Many people at Palantir, myself included, have rigorous debate and have many discussions and disagreements about this. But we ultimately think that the impact and the mission of HSI in particular is important enough. 3,000 child predators and 850 kids being saved because of our work, that this is, it's worth sticking with the government in this instance.
And now he finally admitted that. So it was very smart of Edward to catch that, because they have sort of changed their line a little bit, like slightly tweaked it over the years. And now they've finally just full on admitted, like, here's what we do and why we do it.
Yeah, no, it's a great story. It's worth staying on these giant companies that actually mean so much to our society that don't always get the attention we need to give them.
Yeah. So you have had a series of scoops as well, and there's also been a bunch of movement on the base, which I know we've had a couple episodes about, or at least talked about in a few roundups. I think one full episode, couple roundups.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the latest there?
So the base is a domestic, I would say more like an international domestic neo-Nazi terror group. And they're, one of the latest things that came out about them is that their leader, Ronaldo Nazzaro, that's his identity was revealed by The Guardian and BBC. We knew him as Norman Spear and Roman Wolf. He is somebody who lives in Russia. So that's one thing. And there's a, we know now that there was a undercover FBI informant who was kind of taking apart this group. They uncovered that there was a murder plot against some Antifa activists, which is really, really insidious. And then we also know that, building off a story that we broke in December, a fugitive Canadian soldier who came over the border illegally was being harbored by the group, and he was also planning on going to a Virginia gun rally to shoot it up. So there's a series of arrests.
This is the Virginia gun rally.
This is the Virginia gun rally. I covered it for Vice.
On Martin Luther King Day. Thousands of people activists.
Yeah, thousands of people carrying assault rifles in front of the state capitol. It was absolutely mind-blowing in a lot of ways. You're like, this is an army. And there's the government. This is the center of the government for the state. And there's an army outside. It's not the government army. It's the citizen army. I mean, whatever way you fall on that spectrum, that's notable. And it's interesting and weird.
Yeah, and you were there, and I'd like to talk to you about it, but I think let's just wait for the doc to come out.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
But we had one also other scoop we want to talk about, because it was quite funny. So one of the members...
So anyways, they were arrested.
They were arrested. Yeah. So one of the members that was specifically harboring this Canadian soldier fugitive, Mark Lemley, we found his Nazi Tinder page. So Nazi Tinder is called, it's one of the Nazi Tinders out there. It's called Wasp Love. It's literally for white nationalists and like white supremacists to find love. To find love with someone who's got a similar worldview. And let me tell you, Jason, we found his profile and it was pretty interesting.
I don't know what the word is. It's definitely, I guess, funny, but there's not a lot funny around.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I'm going to pull it up because it was...
Some of it is pretty banal in that it's just like, oh, I'm just looking to have babies and...
Yeah, but also like I'm looking to like find someone who also hates everybody.
Yeah, so there have been a lot of studies, or at least a couple studies, suggesting that there really aren't that many women on these sites.
No,
they're not like super active.
No, but we do know that he actually did. I mean, to some extent, he was on there, and I know that there are actually women on it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think it was just more this ridiculous story that we found this guy who's now charged with being a part of this crazy domestic terror group. And he was out there like on a limb trying to find, you know, love. And not just any type of love. Nazi love, my friend.
Yeah, I think it's it is instructive and notable, like, these people have normalized their hate to the level that, A, they're open about it, but B, they're still people who have to, like, be out there in the world.
Yes.
And this is sort of evidence of that. I think we often talk about this as a very amorphous, theoretical thing, but these are real people making real terror plans and also living their lives among us.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, it's, I hate to say it, but it's kind of like Nazi terrorists, they're like us too, kind of weird story where it's just like, in the midst of all this horrific stuff these people are saying, they're also like, yeah, I need to find a wife and make a homestead. And it's a weird thing, you know, this whole investigating this entire group. And we were the ones who originally broke the news of this group's existence to begin with in 2018.
And yeah, you were embedded in various of their chat rooms and that sort of thing.
And I think the craziest thing now, looking back on it and seeing where what it's become, is that it has become exactly what we thought it would, a scary domestic terror organization that was plotting real violence and also trying to find Nazi love.
Yeah.
Well, that is The Cipher.
Thanks for having me.
Bye. This week's episode was recorded by Brian Arnold, edited by Ricardo Contreras, and produced and voiced by me, Ben Maku. You'll hear from us next week.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.